There's a big discussion going on right now whether social web technologies have a political impact or not. People like Clay Shirky and Cory Doctorow see a positive impact of the web and its possibilities, while people like Yevgeny Morozov have doubts that the internet will lead to more democracy and political change. Do you think that, well, there's a need for a theory of some kind of web activism to explain those effects?
Well, I think what we do need is more data and less anecdotes. That's for sure. Because right now we're all mostly arguing just with anecdotes. So, you know, in the case of the United States, I think I can say with confidence Barack Obama would not be president if it were not for how skillfully he used the internet. Hillary Clinton probably would have won the Democratic nomination. In Iran, obviously, the protesters of the recent election there were not successful. You know, people like Clay Shirky, who thought that, quote, this was the big one, you know, were mistaken. It was big in the sense that social media helped sharpen world attention on what was going on inside Iran, but that didn't change the internal power dynamics. What's going on in Egypt now is a battle, and interestingly enough, the some of the young movement organizers at the heart of this uprising clearly studied what didn't work in Iran, and you know, were adaptive, thought about tactics that they could use so that their protests could in effect swarm around the police state. So we, you know, I think this is an ongoing argument. I personally think that evidence will ultimately show absolutely that the internet is a game changer. It alters the dynamics of organizing communication in ways that shift power subtly but importantly towards ordinary people and away from closed hierarchical institutions. Yeah. And that will, you know, that's where I think Yevgeny Morozov, though, if you read his book Net Delusion carefully, I think you will find that he is on all sides of this question.
You just said in the beginning, you said we need less stories and more data. How can you actually measure the impact of political, like online political activism? Well, how can you measure this impact? Is it possible?
Well, again, you know, the hard part is that you don't get to do an experiment with a control, right? Because this is real life. You know, there are cases that we know of, certainly in the United States, where if you, for example, remind people using text messaging to their phones, you know, that an election is coming up and that today is election day, and click here to get a reminder of where your polling place is, that turnout will go up. And, you know, this goes along with other literature that shows that direct personal connections in politics drive participation. The most effective tools for involving people in politics are knocking on their doors and talking to them, or hearing from your friends. So to the degree that social media is building more connections between people than used to be, and it's certainly making the velocity of those connections move faster. You know, imagine how much time it would take to stuff 100 envelopes with a flyer and then lick the stamps and put them, write the addresses on them, and today it's 100 emails in no time.
Yeah.
The one place where Evgeny makes, I think, a very good counter-argument is whether the ease of use is actually degrading the quality of the communication. In other words, we think we've actually done something by retweeting or by friending something, or, you know, that in fact we have not changed power in the slightest, but we feel better. And that is a danger, that, you know, we will, the symbolic acts will replace real acts. But most organizers I know who work in this space And Personal Democracy Forum, the organization I run, you know, we've been doing this now for 8 years, gathering internet organizers, political activists, and hackers. They will tell you that there is a ladder of engagement, and it starts at a very low level. And if all you manage to do is get someone to friend a cause or friend a candidate, that's an entry point for a richer conversation. And in the past, you didn't even have that ability to make that connection with a very weak supporter and then try and move them up the ladder of engagement. So organizers, I think, would say that these tools are helping them, not hurting them.
Okay, apart from saying that the internet can be an entry point to real activism, Morozov and others, they say that even if you look at the, like what people call the Twitter or Facebook revolution, there are not enough people that actually use these tools for activism. So there's always the discussion about quantity of connections and quantity of people who actually use this. Don't you think we have to go beyond the argument of numbers?
Oh, well, the truth is that we are beyond the argument of numbers. I think what you're seeing is a, you know, there's a popularization of the use of these tools now. And so people in the mainstream media who are usually the last to know about any significant efforts to mobilize for social change have suddenly woken up and said, oh, this Facebook thing, it's not a fad, it's real, I better show that I get it. So they are the ones who are talking the most about the numbers of supporters somebody has on Facebook, where the real organizers, I think, are way beyond that. And what they are looking at are things like super volunteers. We have an understanding that there's a hierarchy of participation online, that 90% of the people who visit a website are only lurking. They're just reading. They don't even bother to comment. They, you know, that's a bigger step. And maybe 7, 8, 9% will actually leave a comment. And it's only 1 or 2% who will do all the heavy lifting. I mean, Wikipedia has millions of people who have maybe contributed one edit, but only a few thousand who are actually the hardcore that keep that site up and running every day.
Mm. But I mean, what difference does it make now when people are able to communicate and collaborate online? I mean, people mm-hmm. that have not been able to do that before the social web.
Well, I think it's a tremendous shift. I mean, again, we're talking about moving some amount of previously wasted social energy that people spent on watching things like television, completely passive, apolitical kinds of use of their leisure time. And we're talking about shifting a few percent of that, which is hundreds of millions of person hours, into socially engaged activity. And it may be simply the social engagement of editing a page on Wikipedia that is creating the world's greatest free resource of information that we've ever seen, or it may be the social engagement of tracking a politician and making sure that people know the truth about that person. All of these little actions are beginning to add up into an additional power, exerting force on the process that is very different than what elites do. And so we're seeing it slowly but surely disrupting the old systems of power.
Okay. Somehow I heard between the lines some of the effects of this network. So how can these networking effects of the social web, how can they translate into the offline world and into real political actions?
Well, I think that the answer is going to be country by country and probably city by city. And it's going to be up to serious organizers, devoting the time to actually make those conversions matter. And there is no question that there is a lot of noise and chatter and people just looking to advance their careers in all this, that's going on right now. But that the conversion is the holy grail. I mean, this is about figuring out how to use tools that don't cost very much and connections that are very easy to make into disruptions to the status quo. So, for example, we are seeing how protesters around the world are learning from each other how to use dispersed networking tools to basically figure out where the police are and not go where they are, right? So this is happening in London, in England, where, you know, we have these student protests and taking place, and people are mesh networking in order to avoid police kettling, and those same techniques and ways of thinking are now being used in Cairo. And by the way, we saw it happening here in the United States in 2008 around the Republican National Convention. The exact same thing was going on. There was a guy on Twitter who was coordinating all the information he could get about where the police was and sharing that. He wasn't even in Minneapolis where the Republican Convention was happening, but he became a node of vital information because dispersed, meshed networking communications like Twitter make that possible. More and more people are learning how to do this. Similarly, what WikiLeaks represents, if Julian Assange is put in prison and WikiLeaks is shut down, it doesn't matter because the knowledge of how to create a transnational information sharing network is now widely dispersed. And there are similar sites cropping up all over the place.
Yeah. I mean, if we come back to what happened in Tunisia and what is happening now in Egypt, would you say that all this could have happened without things like Facebook or Twitter?
Absolutely. And people have been asking folks in those countries that question, and the general answer they give back is, yes, the revolution would have happened, but it would have taken longer and it would have been bloodier. So, the truth is, of course, revolutions have happened before the existence of social media, or shall I say, using other kinds of social media, including people talking in cafes and passing pamphlets around. But we are now in the 21st century, and these are the tools that people are using. By the way, the key point to me is the extent to which the Internet is a relatively freer space for conversation and collaboration. It's very important to understand it is not perfect. There are many, many ways that people can, in fact, as Evgeny points out in his book, if you're naive about this, creating a Facebook page to start organizing a protest is just a great way to let the secret police know who to arrest. And Facebook has a certain responsibility here, which they haven't completely lived up to either warn users, don't use us, because this may be a very easy way for people to figure out who to arrest, or here's a secure way to use us. But right now they're not doing either. They actually require people to use their real names, which is a great way to for the police to, again, you know, immediately spot who the organizers are. And so we're in a sort of in-between place. The smart organizers are using encryption, and they're covering their tracks in other ways. So, you know, this is a case where it's possible that the old powers of police agencies to spy on citizens are being somewhat neutralized. Not completely, but somewhat.
Okay. You partly actually already answered half of the question I'm going to ask you now. Mm-hmm. If we just say that the Internet really has a significant impact on politics and therefore society, what would change if that was really true and all over the place as accepted? What effect will this have on the way we see the Internet and the way, especially the way governments see the Internet?
Well, it's a double-edged sword, isn't it? It is absolutely disruptive to the status quo. We are growing more and more accustomed to the idea that we have the power in our own hands, literally, you know, with our smartphones, to know instantaneously what's actually going on and to share that with each other. And by definition, governments have existed for a long time by monopolizing information and spinning and, you know, manipulating. So these things are now in sharper contradiction with each other. The flip side, though, is, and what we're beginning to see, certainly in some parts of the world, is a new kind of open government that allows for cooperation and collaboration with citizens in a new way to actually make things work better. That, and this is especially true at the city level, where cities are opening up a lot of their data and enabling hackers and developers to create wonderful new tools so that city services will work better and citizens can help each other. And in effect, we self-govern, or we call it we government, right, rather than e-government. And so the question of our time, I think, is whether the people who fear the disruptive effects of open information clamp down, and that is absolutely a strong position. We have a lot of people in the United States government who are arguing, you know, they're waving this threat of cyber war and talking about cybersecurity, and they actually are calling for somehow re-engineering the internet so that they have a backdoor into every communication anyone makes, which I think is frankly insane, versus people who are saying, actually, a more open government is going to be able to tap into widely dispersed sources of information, that the public is actually smarter than the bureaucrats, and that if we allow for a more porous relationship where there's sharing and you know, a process of trial and error, we actually can make things work better, and we'll save money. And, you know, and maybe we won't need as many bureaucrats. So, you know, there's, I think, a colossal, you know, kind of conflict coming between those two visions of the future, and I don't know which one will win.
You already mentioned the problem of speed. I mean, is the rest of the social structure and or even the political structure ready for the possible rapid changes that the internet would allow? I mean, because of the speed of information and communication and its possible impacts, it's so much higher than the possible reaction in the real world. I mean, political decisions sometimes take years or even decades, while information flows within seconds. So is the real political offline world ready for this speed?
Well, I think you're actually raising an excellent point. It's the one I worry about the most. I think that I would just say, first of all, I would suggest that you stop drawing distinction between online and offline, because they are completely merged now, right? A government official with a BlackBerry in his pocket is both online and offline, right? And speed is absolutely the piece. Speed and volume, right? The internet has no limits on capacity the way that the old media did. So the issue is whether we can adapt and develop better filtering systems for this tidal wave of information that's coming at us all the time. And I think that, you know, there's market opportunities here for new forms of media. You know, the old media, the newspaper, the magazine, you had professional editors who, in effect, filtered raw information and then told you what was important each day, right? Now we all know that that's a flawed system because of the biases of those people. And besides, we can all get to this information ourselves. The problem, as you're pointing out, is there's too much of it. And so what I am seeing happen is that people are beginning to form their own sensory networks through their friends and other people that they trust, and that those networks of eyes and ears, in effect, filter what's important. And thus, you know, I'm only looking at the things that people are forwarding to me or that people are retweeting, who I've already determined are trustworthy guides. Issue number one with that is whether we end up in silos. And so I'm only going to listen to the people I already agree with, maybe, and thus the internet may create more polarization. We don't know. There's argument, the academic literature on this is divided. But the other one is no question that the velocity of information is absolutely damaging to our ability to know with confidence. You know, we had a case here in the United States a few weeks ago where a congresswoman was shot, an attempted assassination, and, you know, of course the media swarmed around the story, and a few of them got it wrong and said that she'd been killed. And then later they had to retract that. We've had this problem of mistakes before. Now it's even going to happen faster and more visibly. But I think, you know, look, we're human beings. We've managed to adapt to all the other aspects of the information revolution over the last, 500 years since Gutenberg, invented movable type. In those first 100 years, we didn't have a distinction between fiction and nonfiction. They were just printed words. And then, pretty soon people said, wait a second, some of these words are clearly not real, that's fiction. But we didn't have a label for it. I think we're going to evolve similar systems for managing these new flows of information. And the question is whether we as a society will learn to be more media literate. That is a big challenge. And so I'm very glad that you asked that question.
Okay, so I mean that we as individuals, as people, can adapt. I think it's not that much of a doubt. But don't you think it's even more difficult for those old grown structures in political systems? How can they adapt? I mean, how do you see them adapting? I mean, you mentioned open data, so governments open up and create interfaces to the online social sphere. So, but how do you see governments reacting or adapting to this new reality? And in contrast, how do you think they should react?
Well, the issue is there are two parts. One is what should governments do in normal times and what should they do during crises? And I would argue that they shouldn't wait for a crisis to happen to develop their plan for, managing and being part of a real-time media circus. They have to already be engaging and have developed sort of a trusted relationship with the public. And they can't assume that the old approach, which was to withhold information and dribble it out in a very controlled way, is going to serve them well. That approach breeds distrust. When a crisis hits is when you see the gap between the old practice and the new reality most obviously. And that's when, governments should admit that they are also turning to the public for help to understand what's going on and should admit that, in fact, the public is resilient and that we together can filter and figure out an understanding rather than, putting a government official out to say, the situation is, this happened in the case of in London when the subways were bombed. They were first saying that it was just a power surge. That they had to later retract. The public was already, people were taking pictures right inside the tube tunnels, with their cell phones and sending them to the BBC saying this was a bombing when the government was still saying it was a power surge. So you don't want to be caught in that position where suddenly your authority and your credibility have been terribly damaged because your information methods were so old-fashioned. And we are now all capable of watching and observing and sharing the reality that we see around us. This is very powerfully important. It's why the movement in Egypt has been succeeding, I think. They were able to get, photos of police beating up ordinary citizens and, before and after photos of people who were killed and then put them up on YouTube, put them up on Facebook where people could see for themselves the reality of what the police were doing. That is a very powerful corrective to to state-run media telling you that everything's fine.
Yeah, that's true. That's why they actually closed down the internet, right?